Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, and I am the pastor of Denver Bible Church, and you are invited to come on out this Sunday morning or Sunday night. We're going to have a good time. One of our callers from, what, a week ago? We had a caller on twice talking about how to fix the country, and it turns out he's accepted an invitation to Denver Bible Church to have a bit of a debate in Sunday school on typical conservative right-wing ideas on how to fix the country. For example, we got to go back to the Constitution. And so we had a bit of a debate about that on the air, and we thought it would be fun to continue it. So you're invited to hear that this Sunday morning at Denver Bible Church. All right, in Iraq, the Iraqi front to our war on terror, the news, good and bad news, has heated up in just the last few days. And there are some who say that really what we should do is let the international community be in charge there. In fact, even the United Nations, they already turned tail and ran when the going got tough. But some say the United Nations should be in charge. Well, even if there were no shooting going on, the bad guys weren't shooting those trying to civilize Iraq, would the United Nations be qualified to take over there? Would they be qualified? And those in this audience, you guys know what my answer to that would be. But I thought we could get perhaps another view from somebody in the mainstream media, somebody who's been a producer for ABC News, NBC Nightly News, Nightline, for Good Morning America, The Today Show, writer for Time Magazine, Newsmax. I thought we'd ask Stuart Stogel. Stuart, is the United Nations qualified to take over in Iraq?
Well, I think the UN would say it is, but a lot of us who covered the UN have our doubts about it.
Could you, Stuart, I've read some of your writings on Newsmax recently about the UN, and there's a rather startling book coming out written by workers at the UN. Could you share some of that with my audience?
Well, sure. There are three authors writing a book about their exploits working in the UN's peacekeeping activities department. One is a retired employee, two are current employees, and the UN's rather upset about it because under UN rules, if you are current employees and you're writing about your activities inside the organization, you're supposed to get authorization, and these guys didn't.
Mm. And some of what they've written about, well, maybe I could get us started here from what I've read. The book isn't published yet.
But no, it's due out in about 3 weeks.
And you've gotten an advanced copy. And, for example, the UN will send personnel to Cambodia to oversee open and fair elections. And UN personnel who are first-hand accounts about what's going on say this is more like a vacation for the jet set, and they describe parties with drugs and alcohol and sex, and the UN is not exactly giving the world what the world is paying for.
Well, the funny thing is, someone was telling me just yesterday that whenever you're traveling around the world in a hot spot, if you see brand new cars in the middle of a jungle, they're normally UN folks, because the UN folks don't even travel around in used cars. They use new cars.
Right. So this is it's sort of an opportunity for maybe well-connected people to see the world and party without any actual responsibilities or obligations.
Well, they mentioned that back in Cambodia, I think it was 1992 to 1994, where they were sent over, UN was sent over to supervise elections. The UN didn't have enough housing for everybody who was sent over there, so they left it up to a lot of folks to get housing on their own. And supposedly in Phnom Penh, the capital of Cambodia, there was their version of the Playboy Mansion, the Hugh Hefner Playboy Mansion, And it seems that was a favorite spot for UN personnel to live in if they could get accepted. It was almost like a fraternity house.
Right. And so that some people might look at that and say, well, that's overseeing open and fair elections. That's not really a hard function. That's sort of a soft function. But when the UN really rolls up their sleeves is when they send in troops for peacekeeping efforts. And it seems like even regarding peacekeeping efforts, the UN has quite a lot of embarrassing, dirty laundry to hide.
Yes, just a few days ago, speaking about peacekeeping troops, Amnesty International made the allegation that UN troops currently in Kosovo, part of the former Yugoslavia, are involved in white slave trade as well as sex trade operations.
And that comes not from a right-wing group that's traditionally against the UN, but that's an accusation from Amnesty International. How about the UN's practice of reimbursing member nations for peacekeeping troops?
Right, that's a common practice. If your country donates troops, the UN provides money per head per soldier. And we're getting at, back in 1994, the Cambodian election situation. The Bulgarians, the Eastern Europeans, especially Bulgaria, needed hard currency since of the collapse of the Soviet Union. They had no source of hard income, so they offered troops. The problem, according to the book, was that many of their regular troops didn't want to go to Cambodia because they saw it as a big mess. So the Bulgarians decided to go to their prisons and offer convicts pardons if they served with the UN.
So they took prisoners and sent them as the blue-helmeted UN peacekeepers to Cambodia, and the country got reimbursed, and the prisoners told they'd get out of jail free.
Right, exactly. And when they couldn't get enough prisoners, they actually went, according to the book, to a few psychiatric wards and offered a few psychiatric patients the same deal. Work with the UN for 6 months, and you'll get a reprieve.
Now, this book is not written by outsiders. This is coming from within the bowels of the United Nations.
Oh, yes. And in fact, someone was telling me, which is not in the book, that some of these Bulgarian troops, when they were in Cambodia back in the mid-90s, actually had an incident where they raped and accosted some women and children that were later found to be families of Khmer Rouge officials, the Khmer Rouge being one of the main factions, military factions in Cambodia. And from what I was told, when the Khmer Rouge realized who had raped their women and children, they went back and wiped out a good chunk of the Bulgarian peacekeepers.
Wow. I wonder why we didn't hear Senator Ted Kennedy on the floor of the Senate railing against the United Nations in there.
Well, it's kind of funny because also in the book, there is an allegation that in the massacres in Rwanda and Burundi, the African countries back in 1994, where about 600,000 people were massacred, the book alleges that the Canadian general commanding UN troops in the region sent a report to the peacekeeping chief, and who at that time was Kofi Annan, warning him of an impending massacre, and Annan sat on the information.
Well, that's the story from Rwanda, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where eventually 800,000 people or so were murdered.
Right. The book alleges that Kofi Annan sat on the information, because he was head of peacekeeping at the time, because the French were allied with one of the Rwandan factions and didn't want anything to happen until they could get those folks out of the country before they would be massacred. And as such, the French sat on the information, forced Kofi to sit on the information, and the UN stood by and did nothing, when, as you say, almost 800,000 people lost their lives.
Well, Stuart Stoll, if I recall this also, the New York Times, some years ago, printed the communiques back and forth from the UN field general in Rwanda and Kofi Annan and his office. And they printed the transcripts of those documents, and the plea for action was very urgent and clear that there's a likely genocide coming if we don't act. Kofi Annan returned an instruction forbidding any kind of action. And so, you know, nearly in round numbers, nearly a million black people are slaughtered through at least incompetence. And it seems, if you look at it, the reward or the punishment that Kofi Annan was given by the world body was he was promoted to be the head of the UN, the Secretary General of the United Nations.
Yes, and he did that with the backing of Madeleine K. Albright and Bill Clinton.
Right. What a great point. It seems that, I mean, Hitler we despise because of all his other crimes. He murdered 6 million Jews. There are plenty of people who are culpable for doing nothing or standing by. So the United Nations had the opportunity at least to make noise about the impending slaughter of almost 1 million people. And the one man who was responsible, who was as incompetent as could be, his incompetence directly led to a genocide of almost 1 million people, and he's rewarded by being made the head of the UN.
And it's also ironic because he's the first black African secretary general, too.
Right. It's eerily reminiscent of Margaret Sanger and some of her early writings. So the United Nations, Stuart, when I look at that world body over the years, I've been on the air for over 12 years now. It seems to me that if there's any issue that smacks of any Judeo-Christian morality or traditions, the UN is squarely against it, squarely against America and Israel and Judeo-Christian morals.
Well, believe it or not, some ambassadors have actually said that to me privately.
An ambassador at the UN?
Yes.
In other words, confirming what is our observation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
All right. And now, let me ask you this. The UN, probably one of the things it does most often in every year is vote on resolutions condemning Israel. That seems to be a major pastime.
Right, exactly.
That's their CPU idle activity process. That's what they do. And so I wonder, do you know, has it ever been raised, for example, Palestinians on their TV stations, they really encourage young people to join the Intifada. And certainly even the UN's own Convention on the Rights of the Child condemns the use of children in war zones.
Oh, yes. I mean, the United Nations, because of the membership situation, is very, very much pro-Arab. Unfortunately, the Arab group itself has around 22 members, but because of the oil money, that
right.
basically balloons up where they normally get a resolution to pass neither the General Assembly or the Security Council. In the Security Council, there is a veto. The Americans can veto it, and they often do. So if it was not for the United States, Lord knows what would have happened to Israel.
Yeah, so that the has the world body ever condemned the Palestinians for using children in combat?
No, but the United States has raised the issue several times in the Security Council, and many U.S. allies, mainly the French, the British, the Chinese, or the Russians, are normally silent on that issue.
Mm-hmm. Stuart, do you have what is your sense of why? Let's talk about just right now France and Germany. Why they were so staunchly opposed for us getting rid of a mass murderer. The New York Times, page one of the New York Times a year ago, they calculated that Saddam Hussein was responsible for the violent deaths of about 1 million people. About 1 million people. Why do you think, and maybe I'll ask you then, what do you think about my rationale, why do you think France and Germany are so staunchly opposed to us getting rid of a mass murdering dictator?
It's very simple. It boils down to two words, oil contracts.
Oil contracts. Their countries received a lot of money illegally from Saddam, money that was effectively stolen from the Iraqi people. It was supposed to go for food and humanitarian aid to the Iraqi people. The profits instead were skimmed off by companies and perhaps governing officials in France and Germany.
Well, you have to remember one thing. Iraq has an oil field. An oil field that has not been developed in northeastern Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told this by several former Iraqi officials and by several U.S. oil companies. And this oil field has the potential of being so large, it would catapult Iraq ahead of Saudi Arabia
wow.
as the number one oil producer. And the French, the Germans, and the Russians all want in on this.
So they want in on that. Okay, so I see that as obviously that's a financial motive. And so they're willing to make close-door deals with a mass murderer for the buck. where they accused America of going to war for oil, which doesn't seem to be true. If it did, you'd think our oil prices would go down, not up. But actually, those who were opposed to the war were willing to see the slaughter of thousands, tens of thousands of Iraqis so that they can make oil profits themselves.
Well, that's true. And, of course, if you were to ask the Russians, the British, not the British, but the Russians or the French or the Germans, they would say, well, they don't condone slaughters of innocent civilians.
Oh, yeah.
But on the same context, they'll say, well, that's an internal matter that we shouldn't get involved with.
Right. So let me give you my analysis, Stuart, of why I think France and Germany, public opinion was so strongly against attacking Iraq. I think oil revenues, the average guy in the street doesn't know about that, right?
Probably not, but they'll soon find out about it as we see prices approaching $2 to $3 a gallon.
All right, but here's why I think that public opinion in those countries were so much in favor of Iraq. It's two, I'll give you two words, vicarious anti-Semitism. Vicarious anti-Semitism. In France and Germany, it's not politically correct to be a racist against the Jews. But Saddam Hussein and his regime hated the Jews, funded Islamic terrorism, Palestinian terrorism, to kill Jewish families. And while those in, say, in Germany and even in France during World War II, all the hatred for the Jews, they can't publicly satisfy those dark desires. But by supporting a regime, a murderous regime like Saddam Hussein's that was so virulently anti-Israel, it's vicarious anti-Semitism. I think that's the main reason some of old Europe was against us liberating Iraq.
I don't know if it would be the reason, but it may be one of several main reasons.
All right. All right. So, Stuart Stokel, we only have another couple minutes to let people know how to find you and your writings. Is Newsmax the best place to go?
Right. You can go either to Newsmax.com or you can go to the Time website, which is Time.com.
All right. Time.com. We've been seeing you at Newsmax.com. Mm-hmm. And Stuart, I want to thank you for getting out this these stories that the mainstream media doesn't seem to want to cover any longer. About
well, they're right, because I know for a fact the Associated Press and Reuters are both now aware of this UN book, and they're trying to get their hands on a copy to write their own stories.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you very much, Stuart Stokel. We appreciate you having you on.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. All right. Our phone number, 1-800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. So the United Nations, we call it the UN. The UN. And the UN is broken. The UN hates America and hates Israel primarily. In Europe, public opinion polls asking in the last year, which countries are the most dangerous to the world? I think America and Israel came in first and second. Or maybe Israel came in first, America second. Which was it? So, and there are reasons for that, of course. You know, when Germany slaughtered millions of innocent people and tried to deny tens of millions of freedom and nations of their sovereignty, America went over to Europe and liberated Europe from that Nazi tyranny and mass murder. And then what we did was we didn't occupy and try to take over Germany. We helped them rebuild their country. That's what we did. We helped them rebuild their country. And when Japan attacked us unjustly at Pearl Harbor, slaughtered over 3,000 Americans, after we defeated the Japanese, we helped them to rebuild their country. And for all the faults of America, you're hard-pressed to find a nation in history that has been more gracious to its enemies. You're more hard-pressed. And you see, the problem we have as conservative Christians is we have to defend our country with K caveats because of the miserable filth that America puts out to the rest of the world. Ben Nighthorse Campbell was one of the senators today who viewed the additional photos and videos from Iraq, the sexual humiliation of Iraqi prisoners of war, detainees. And he, in disgust, he said, how could these people have gotten into our military? And I sort of think he's a U.S. senator. How naive can he be? How naive can he be? If these videos, if these snapshots were on American cable TV program, people would chuckle at him. They'd laugh at him. If it was Howard Stern humiliating people who guest or people unwittingly. Sometimes you try to say your name. You ever try to say your name? Bob Enyart. Somebody said, what's your name? Bob Enyart. Enyart. That's it. That's how. I just washed my mouth and I can't do a thing with it. Unwittingly. Somebody ends up unwittingly on Howard Stern's TV program, and he'll do all he can to sexually humiliate him. You know how I know that? I stayed a night at at the home of a U.S. Marshal in Washington, D.C. And sadly, he and his wife, and they had a couple young kids, they apparently watch Howard Stern every day. How could that be? I can't quite comprehend it. And the wife is making dinner in the kitchen, and the husband, I'm sitting there to talk with. I'm going to spend the night at their home. They're putting me up. I did a guest appearance on a talk TV show in Washington. And Howard Stern is on. And the show, he had a woman on as a guest who was an artist. And her drawings hung on the walls of a bar in Manhattan. And what made her interesting is because she drew on Etch-a-Sketch. So they took down some of the pictures from the walls of the bar to bring it on to show them on TV. And she's there with an Etch-a-Sketch. And she drew the most gorgeous pictures with Etch-a-Sketch. And I thought, wow, I didn't know Howard Stern was so interested in culture. Not that that's high culture, but, you know, it's Etch-a-Sketch culture. At any rate, the only thing Howard Stern wanted to do was to embarrass this woman and ask her questions about her sex life with her husband. That was it. That was it. And she refused to answer in a dozen different ways. She wouldn't answer. And he just kept going. And so I guess she probably knew what to expect from Howard Stern. I don't know. I don't know if she watched Howard Stern. But sexual humiliation is what passes as humor in America's culture. And I think we were probably the first on the air to point out that what's happening is a result of our culture, what has happened. So Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell writes, how could these people have gotten into our military? And I'm thinking, huh? What is he talking about? Ever since we put women on submarines, there have been sexual immorality scandals and more pregnant semen in the Navy than you could shake a stick at. What is he talking about? How do these people get in the military? So I share his disgust, and when they want to see who is responsible. Those who are responsible are the U.S. Supreme Court judges and the lawmakers and those in the media who have destroyed America's culture and turned it into filth. That's who's responsible. So that when we stand before God on Judgment Day, now, it depends on what kind of church you go to, if you know this or not, but the Bible teaches over and over and over and over that on Judgment Day, the Christians will be judging the world, that we will judge. Most Christians have a picture of God on the throne judging, and he backs up our judgment, but God delegates judgment into the hands of his saints. The Apostle Paul says, "Do you not know that we will judge the angels? Do you not know that we will judge the world?" Jesus Christ said that the men of Nineveh would rise up and judge his generation. And the Bible, from Old to New Testament, tells us that it's those who are saved by God, forgiven of their sins, we will judge the world. And so on Judgment Day, when it comes time to render judgment and punishment for these crimes that occurred in this prison in Iraq, who will be punished? Who is responsible? Well, most directly, it's those who were the perpetrators. Those who were the perpetrators. We've read the reports where there's no evidence that any policy or any chain of command gave orders to behave in that way. We've read those reports. And if Ted Kennedy or any of the Democrats had evidence that there were any policy directives that were being implemented, of course, we'd all know about it. So they have no evidence that any chain of command or policy was responsible for what happened. And then when the liberals and others have said that the training was insufficient, that makes me sick. The training was insufficient? What, you need training to know not to pose prisoners in naked homoerotic positions? You need training to know that? What, training has to cover absolutely every possible filth and form of torture? You need training to know you don't poke out your prisoner's eyes with a fork? You got to be told that? You don't have a brain cell? So it's not an issue of training. It's not an issue of training. It's an issue of immorality, and it's the culture. So on Judgment Day, when we see the people who, the additional lives that were lost, people killed because those photographs gave comfort and aid to the enemy by giving them added zeal to attack and kill Americans. And when it's time to judge those responsible, those who perform those actions will be responsible. And those in the U.S. Supreme Court who have turned our culture into a culture of filth, they will be responsible. And the legislators who've approved of it and the governing officials who tolerate it and look the other way, they'll be responsible. The current crackdown at the FCC on indecency, is it because of the current administration? No. Who do we have to thank for that? It's because of Janet Jackson. We're so far gone, we don't even know that we have a filthy culture. Hey, we're out of time. This is Bob Inyart reminding you to do right and risk the consequences.